Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. And boy, do I have some insights today. We're going to be talking with one of my very favorite guests, Tom Philpott, in case you don't know him. Tom is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. He is also the co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Cruces, North Carolina. And he was formerly a columnist and editor for the online environmental site Grist, and his work on food politics has appeared in Newsweek, Gastronomica, and The Guardian, as well as others, I'm sure. Tom, thanks so much for doing the show. I'm so sorry I like spaced on this, but I'm telling you, the jet lag from Australia, it hurts. It really hurts.
No problem, Katie. Just glad you're back safe.
It was a great trip. We had a really good time. We were wined and dined royally, taken all around cattle and sheep ranches and slaughterhouses in Queensland and New South Wales. And
It sounds like the ultimate ag nerd tour.
It totally
Australia.
Was, man. I was so in my element. And I'm sure I drove the chefs that I was traveling with absolutely insane. I was just relentless.
What is the water situation there in Australia? I understand it's pretty constrained in general.
It is pretty constrained in general, but like the sort of the Napa Valley area, which I would say is the New South Wales where their wine grows, you know, all their wineries are and stuff like that. That seemed pretty verdant to me. They didn't seem to be in any great distress. There certainly are areas of drought, but they don't seem to be all that concerned about it. I think they're kind of used to it. And then, you know, in the Queensland area, they this is another entire discussion, but just I'll just briefly say that what they do there is breed their animals to be able to withstand various climate issues, including hot and dry. So unlike what we do when we breed cattle, which is sort of like breed to the breed, they breed to the climate. And that's going to be another entire show. But that was so interesting to me. And, among the many, many other things that were interesting and exciting and inspiring about their agricultural systems, which don't seem to be, and I will conclude this part of the program now, they don't seem to be basically dictated by lobbyists. It's a much cleaner situation over there. And you and I will talk about that another time. But anyway, let us get right into the business of the business here. And we are talking about two sort of longstanding issues that you've been covering for Mother Jones and I think before that for Grist. And one of them is the algae blooms that we heard about in the early part of August in Toledo, Ohio. But they are by no means the only city that has experienced these giant blue-green algae blooms that are attributable to various toxins that are entering their water system. So why don't you give us an update on what's happening in Toledo now? Because, you know, the mayor famously drank a glass of water.
Yeah. Well,
I was so inspired by that.
About a month ago, I think it was, the city water treatment people there got a reading from their city water saying that it was unsafe to drink based on this toxin that comes out from blue-green algae. And they draw their water from Lake Erie, a very particular part of Lake Erie that we'll get into a little bit more in a second. But so they basically had to shut down. They didn't shut down the water, but they had to put a warning at the citizens, please don't drink this water. It's got, you know, alarming levels of this toxin that can cause liver damage.
At the very least, it makes you very sick. It's, you know, food poisoning can make
you very sick immediately, and if you drink too much of it over time, you can get liver damage.
Right.
So for about 48 hours, the residents of the city were told, don't drink the water, and don't think you can boil it and clean it that way. It'll just concentrate the toxins.
Oh, great.
It sparked, predictably, like any of us would do. Everyone ran out and got as much bottled water as they could. And
sure.
There was a coordinated effort to move it into the city. But this is not the kind of thing that inspires confidence in your city's water supply.
No.
And so, predictably enough, you're asking about an update. Several weeks on, the city is dealing with constant rumors of another toxin scare, rumors that another warning is going to come out and that's drink the water imminently. You're seeing runs on water.
Yeah.
And, the city officials and the mayor are kind of beside themselves trying to deal with this, is what I'm reading in the local media from
sure.
up there.
Have you
and
checked
so, you
in
know,
with...
It makes it a very sort of insecure situation. And I think a lot of people there, even before this latest scare, because, this has been going on for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And a nearby community, a small community that draws its water from a different place in Lake Erie, had a situation very, very similar last year. And I think these are the first instances in the U.S. of people being told they can't drink their water based on these blue-green algae blooms and the toxins that they generate.
So let's go back for a second and deconstruct what is the blue-green algae and what it's mycocystin or something is the name of the toxin. And what causes this blue-green algae and what can be done about it?
Right. Okay. So Lake Erie, it's, obviously in the upper Midwest, and the part where this town, the city of Toledo draws its water is kind of in the southeastern corner of Lake Erie. And it's in a part where a huge amount of corn and soy farming drains into it's sort of this basin where runoff from these areas drain into the lake.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty simple concept. So there's a lot of fertilizer going on these farms.
Yeah.
And a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus that sort of stimulates plant growth. These are obviously key nutrients for plants.
Sure.
But when they run off into the water, they don't stop stimulating plant growth, and so they go in, they get into the water, and for reasons I don't fully understand, in freshwater situations like in a lake, phosphorus is a key nutrient, and in saltwater situations like down on the Gulf of Mexico,
uh-huh.
nitrogen is a key nutrient.
How
but
interesting.
these are agricultural nutrients. These are sort of plant nutrients.
Yeah,
and as they get into the lake, they stimulate these algae blooms. And so they're feeding these algae blooms. And I'm looking right now at a map that was on the article. It's sort of a satellite image that's on the article that I posted on this a couple of weeks ago on August 6th. And, from outer space, you can see the green algae covering a huge swath of this lake.
Wow.
And so this toxin. So what happens is... a lot of bad things happen. One thing that happens is that as the bloom dies, it ties up oxygen
uh-huh.
in the water, and so you basically get water that can't support any life because there's not enough oxygen in it. So you get these dead zones in the lake, and that's a big problem.
And that's similar to the dead zones we have in Chesapeake Bay and in the Gulf of Mexico, right? They may be caused by phosphorus versus nitrogen.
Same phenomenon. Those are fed more by nitrogen than phosphorus.
Because they're salt water. But it's the same idea.
So that's all the same. But luckily, no one is, trying to drink water out of the Chesapeake Bay or the Gulf of Mexico. That would be awful.
Yeah.
But they are drinking it out of Lake Erie. And so what happens is a town or a city like Toledo, I should say, will have an inlet, like an inlet pipe out in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
and it will draw water to it. It'll do whatever it does to purify it and send it out to its municipal system. But what happens is that there's a toxin associated with blue-green algae that is it isn't always generated by, in every blue-green algae situation, but it can be generated by the blue-green algae and build up.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened here. And so that the city, you know, there are, I don't believe the EPA has a monitoring program for this toxin. And so I think Toledo is doing the best it can with the terrible hand that it's dealt, because it's constantly testing the water for this toxin and it's on the lookout for it. And, there's a level that I'm looking up for right here. It's a certain number of parts per billion over which it can't be, and they're constantly testing for it. So it's pretty much always there at low levels, but when you get a spike like this, it's when it causes concern.
Unbelievable. How many other places in the states, because that map shows like a lot of places where these blue-green algae blooms are existing, and a lot of them were in the Northeast, I was surprised to see. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, they are looking at the map right now, and they are all over the place. Mm-hmm. Basically anywhere where you get large amounts of agriculture. And one thing that is critical to understand is that your sort of agribusiness kind of take on this question would be, something like, yeah, this is obviously very unfortunate that people's drinking water occasionally gets compromised. But you can't blame this completely on agriculture because there's municipal waste, there's sewage that gets treated and then put back into water supplies.
Sure.
There's natural phosphorus and nitrogen in soil. And the answer to that is pretty clear, that Lake Erie was nearly dead, very famously 30 or 40 years ago.
I remember
and at
that.
One point it set on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, it was getting lots of monster. It was getting agriculture waste, but agriculture wasn't quite as intensive as it is now.
Right.
But it was getting, in some cases, raw sewage.
And a lot of industrial waste.
Lots of industrial phosphorus. Yeah. Phosphorus is an industrial waste product in several industries. So it's getting a lot of industrial pollution that included phosphorus. And so the giant algae blooms it was getting in that era were legitimately caused by municipal waste, industrial waste, and so on. And agriculture played a role, but it wasn't the dominant role. And then the sort of controversy around that sparked the Clean Water Act in the early 70s.
Right.
And when the Clean Water Act was passed, it actually did a really, really good job of dramatically slowing down those other sources of pollution. And there's a great chart on my post that I pulled from a report, the Ohio Lake Erie Phosphorus Task Force, that shows, you can see the fall, the steady fall throughout the 70s, and it stayed very low, of industrial phosphorus going into Lake Erie. But what happened simultaneously was that's when you start to really get the ramping up of corn and soy production and the falling away of other crops, crop rotation, just sort of the intensification, the spread onto more marginal lands. And you can see in that chart that around the same time that the industrial phosphorus is falling, the agriculture-related phosphorus is rising. And flash forward to now, and it's by far the dominant source of phosphorus. You can just look at this chart, and it obliterates the agribusiness case that, it could be these other things. We're not really responsible for it. And so you get this situation where, we're not back to 70s levels, but we're back to mid 70s levels. We're not back to in the 60s it was a free for all, and we're not back up there yet. But we're getting back to where these blooms are appearing again. That they dropped away for many years, for a couple of decades they weren't a significant problem, and now they're back with a vengeance, and agriculture is definitely the driver of it.
Well, you know, that creates a perfect segue for our next segment. So why don't we take a quick and short sponsor drop now, and we'll be right back with Tom Philpott to talk more about agriculture in the United States. So stay tuned.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
So we are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. My name is Katie Kiefer. I think I might have forgotten to introduce myself before. And we are broadcasting from the Heritage Radio Network, just in case there are people who are just tuning in for the very first time. And so on the line today is my guest, Tom Philpott, the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. And we were having a fascinating discussion about agriculture in the United States, and specifically how agriculture is having an impact on our water supplies. And then since we're talking about corn and soy, that leads us right into something else that you've been covering for a really long time, Tom, and that is neonicotinoid pesticides. And that is another aspect of that is having an impact not only on water quality, but especially on that seems to be the cause of colony collapse disorder and a host of other ills. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, give us a sense of like where you, when you started getting interested in this, because, you know, looking back through all your articles, I could see you've been on the story for at least 3 years. And 3 years ago, I think people were really still scratching their heads about colony collapse disorder at the very least. And and now it seems to be becoming more and more clear that it's this kind of pesticide. So tell us about your reporting journey there, and then we'll talk more about what they are.
Yeah, I started writing about neonic pesticides probably 2010 or 11. Mm-hmm. And how I got onto the story was I had heard that a beekeeper in Illinois who was concerned about colony collapse disorder, and in the heart of
corn country,
and let's just, you know, say right off that these pesticides are used universally in corn and soy and several other crops too. So they, you know, they really do blanket the country in agriculture areas, and also they're widely used in sort of golf courses and landscaping and even home gardens. So that, you know, they're really, really prevalent. But so this this beekeeper had been suspecting them of maybe playing a role in colony collapse and decline of bee health. And he had been, you know, sort of in contact with the EPA, trying to figure out what the EPA's stance on it was, and looking at the EPA's process for approving these products, which had been approved in the late 90s and early 2000s, sort of one by one. There are several neonic chemicals that are slightly different, all in the same family. Mm-hmm. And he got a leaked document from someone at EPA leaked him a document that was very interesting, and it basically said that, so when these companies, and the companies in question here are Bayer and Syngenta, and Bayer is a big European, they're both big European.
Is that Bayer Aspirin?
Agrochemical companies. And so Bayer, so the EPA process is that the companies submit data and studies showing that their products aren't harmful. Mm-hmm. And concern, you know, neonics were concerned about bees from the word jump, because no one disputes that they're actually toxic to bees. The question is, at the level that they are used in fields, are they toxic? Are they, you know, in field-relevant situations, are they a significant problem for bees? Mm-hmm. And so EPA asked Bayer to submit some data on that, and they submitted a study finding that they were completely harmless.
Really?
And so, yeah, so this is going through this EPA process, and I don't want to get too bogged down into details, but the EPA has got this very kind of dodgy system where it will grant conditional registration And that's saying, well, we're not convinced that your product is safe because you haven't given us the data yet, but we're going to go ahead and let you use it, and we'll wait for you to get us your data. So they were,
so this
by
is
and large,
really unbelievable.
Approved under conditional registration.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point, like 2010, one of them, Clothindienden, I always have trouble pronouncing these neonic pesticides, got full registration, and this study that Bayer submitted was the main reason why it got full registration.
The study saying that it was completely safe.
Yeah, so it became like fully registered. They could use it. It was declared safe for bees, according to EPA. What the document showed was that EPA scientists found the study to be deeply flawed.
Uh-huh.
It was just sort of bad science. They hadn't done a careful job of isolating the controls and the non-controls, and mm-hmm. didn't give them enough range. And it was just, according to the EPA itself, just really bad science. And so when I had sort of figured all that out and read through the documents, I got really interested in the question.
Yeah.
And at that time, there was, some good studies out implicating neonics in colony collapse disorder and other problems that honeybees are having. But since that time, there have been a bunch of studies. So I would say a weight of evidence has come out. And, here's the thing. Colony collapse disorder is very complicated, and it probably isn't accurate to say that neonics are the cause, because there are many factors impacting honeybees right now. There's uh-huh. loss of habitat. There's less biodiversity out there. There is this thing we do where we basically move about half our honeybees once a year to California, no matter where they are, to pollinate the almond crop, and that mm-hmm. stresses them out. Honeybee makers often feed high fructose corn syrup in the off season when there's not foraging, and that doesn't turn out to be a very good way to feed them. So there are all these different factors.
Uh-huh.
Then you get a couple of there's a mite, which is a parasite that was introduced in the 80s from Japan that affects honeybees, and there's also a couple of viruses that affect honeybees.
Jesus.
But the way that neonics appear to, so you got all these factors, and you can think of it like as this murder mystery. I don't know if that's a good metaphor or not, but you have all these different factors
that
are probably playing a role.
Yeah.
But it appears as though neonics are the thing that pushes it over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
They're the thing that if you could take that away, because one of the things that they do at very low levels, at what we call sub-lethal levels, where it's not enough to kill the bee, knock it over dead,
right?
But it's affecting the bee. It makes bees less effective. This is study after study has shown this. It makes them less effective foragers. It makes colonies less adept at producing new queens.
Wow.
It impacts their immunity. It appears to impact their immunity to some of these
uh-huh.
pathogens and viruses that are in the atmosphere naturally. And
right.
So what it's doing is it's making, it appears to be making honeybee hives less resilient to all these stressors that are out there.
Right.
And that if you could take away that stressor, then they would be more resilient to these things and maybe thrive better.
Uh-huh.
That I'd say is the best way to state the science, is that they're demonstrably making our honeybees, and not just honeybees, but also bumblebees and other pollinators,
right,
less resilient to all this other stuff we're throwing at them.
Right. And you also mentioned that it's having an impact on birds. That there are some bird species that are having turning up dead more often. And there have been some big bird die-offs in the last few years, haven't there? Like, that just occurs to me now. Wasn't there a couple of entire flocks of something just rained down on people's lawns two years ago in the South?
Yeah, I think there have been a couple of those, and that bit had surprised me, this connection to birds. It's only kind of emerging in the last year and a half.
Well, they eat the insects, so why wouldn't they develop
They eat the insects, And they also, you know, that's one way that they would take them up. And then also you
drink
get less forage for them, because if you're killing that many insects, if you're like doing this broad-based kill-off of insects, then there's less forage for birds, and so that impacts them in that way as well. And what I wrote about earlier this, I guess late July, was this new study from the U.S. Geological Survey finding that in waters in the Midwest, they're just full of neonics. They're just everywhere. And that has impacts on, you know, you think about that, in that sort of ecological food chain that birds rely upon, if you get neonics in water, and the neonics in the water are killing forage, you know, the insects that they would forage on, the sort of waterborne creatures that they would forage on, it's giving them less to forage on, and it has these sort of ecological knock-on effects.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this cascading disaster you're watching unfold slowly but surely in front of your eyes. The thing that's so interesting about it, so we started using these in the 90s, is that what you said?
And this was using them in the 90s, and then they really explode in corn country in the early 2000s. Basically, they kind of take over the corn crop around 2004 and start to rise dramatically ever since.
Now, is
corn
this,
and soybeans.
And soy and other crops, as you mentioned. Are the neonicotinoid class of pesticide, this is rising up in conjunction with the increased use of Roundup Ready crops? Is that sort of like the whole thing is kind of all part and parcel of what?
There's a lot of debate about how that works, but one thing that we can say, I think, is that if you think about BT corn, let's say, with, you know, because Roundup Ready, it's hard to figure out a relationship with that, because Roundup is an herbicide, and maybe by
but they still have to use
weeds,
pesticides, right?
Yeah, there's some impact, but BT corn started in earnest in the mid 90s, and then by the 2000s, almost all corn is now BT. So it's expressing this insecticide.
Right.
One thing I find really interesting is that the industry says that since you've got this stuff in the corn, you're going to need less, fewer pesticides.
Yeah, right. That's what I thought the whole point of it was.
And yet, at the same time, you get this universal embrace of neonics, and so it you can at least say that BT corn did not, solve the insect problem if these farmers are relying so much
on
neonics. But it's also there's a seed industry story here too, because these neonics are seed treatments, and so it's just really interesting technology. Instead of spraying neonics in the field in corn and soy country, they do it in other, like in landscaping, they might spray neonics.
Right.
But in corn and soy country, you buy seeds that are treated with them. And so what happens is you plant it, and they're taken up actually in the crop, in the leaves, and the pollen, and the nectar of the crop as it grows. And so they're just sort of ubiquitous in these fields. And it's really hard now to get corn and soy that isn't treated with neonics. It's just sort of what the companies are doing now. It's just part of your package. And so when you buy your corn seed, if you go with the flow of what most farmers do now, what most seed suppliers are selling now, you're getting corn with a couple different BT genes, a couple of neonics treated with them, and so you're getting this corn that's got all these pesticides built into it, and it's like it's almost analogous to feeding your livestock antibiotics every day on the idea that, well, I'm going to prevent a disease. I'm not going to wait for a disease to start up. I'm going to go ahead and try to prevent it before it happens, and that's kind of the mentality we're getting with these crops. Like, let's treat the seeds and let the insects work themselves out before we ever see a problem.
But I got to go back to this concept of, like, the whole point of Roundup Ready, of BT corn, and modified soy and all of that was partly to to express a pesticide. So why are they using, why is it, if this is going to be such an effective technology, why is it that neonicotinoids came up just about at the same time and became this blanket use? I mean, I'm scratching my head over that. Like, I really hadn't made that connection until we had this conversation. Like, I didn't realize that they were using, even though they're doing BT corn, which is theoretically going to repel insects in by its very nature, and yet at the same time they're blanketing these crops, these seeds, with another, yet another pesticide. So why do they even need that?
I think the part of it is this mentality in industrial agriculture that you have to maximize yield. You have to you have to take every precaution possible. And, you know, especially if you look at this last 10 years, you know, by the mid-2000s, we're seeing this huge rise in corn prices based on ethanol, which is now being pulled back.
It's being phased out.
In the last year or so. But you're seeing this this spike in corn and soy prices. And I think there's this mentality of, I want to catch every bit of that as possible. And if I pay a little bit extra for my corn because it's got a couple of neonics built into it, that's going to be worth it because it's like an insurance policy against insect problems. I will insure myself maximum yield, and when I go to sell my corn at $6 or $7 a bushel, I'll be cashing in as much as possible. I think that's the sort of mentality of, like, you don't wait for a problem to develop. You try to nip it in the bud before it happens.
Right.
But you're not thinking about the overall impact. You know, one thing that should be said is that these neonics are, they are marketed, and to an extent they really do replace older, more harsh chemicals that are way more toxic to humans, and I think that's that is a big deal.
Sure.
But I think that, you know, the answer to, you know, I think we've talked about this before, Katie. If you're a corn or soy pest, if you're some insect, let's say, that likes to eat corn, there's no better strategy. There's no better event for you than to blanket huge amounts of corn of acres in the exact same kind of corn every year.
Right,
you've got this smorgasbord laid out for you, and so increases pest pressure and increases you know, the desire to have insecticides.
Sure.
So, a way better answer to phasing out these older, really nasty pesticides is through biodiversity, and that just means crop rotation.
Sure.
But, you know, instead of doing corn every year, or corn, soy, you know, 2 years of corn, 1 year of soy, work other crops into rotation, oats, wheat. And this not only reduces the need for pesticide, but this gets us back to the first part of our conversation.
Right.
It also reduces the need for fertilizers.
That's right.
If you are.
Because you're treating the
herbicide.
Soil correctly.
It breaks up weed patterns, pest patterns, and it's better for the soil.
Yeah. Fascinating. Tom, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I know that you are working on a story about almonds, and I can't wait to read it, and I can't wait to talk to you about that. So keep me in the loop on the almond story, because I've loved some of your posts. All the hipsters who are outraged that you're telling them not to drink their almond milk. You know, that's like crazy.
Well, I look forward to hearing your stuff in Australia.
Oh, dude. I'll be right. Well, I have to write the story up for Food Arts, but then I'm also going to, I think, write something up for the Huffington Post. So I'll pass that along to you when I get that together. So, yeah, it was it was a really interesting trip. And, I'll tell you all about it the next time I see you, actually. I hope you're coming up to New York. Oh, I'll see you at Chef's Collaborative, right?
Are you,
you don't know yet?
At where?
Chef's Collaborative in Boulder? Are you doing that?
I don't know yet.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, the plot thickens. Anyway, Tom, thanks a million for doing this with me today. I really appreciate it. Fascinating conversation, as always. And we'll be talking again real soon. Thanks for listening,
folks. Take care.
And we'll be back the day after, or the week after Labor Day. So long, and thank you for listening, and thanks to my sponsor.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.